Five, four, three, two, one.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in. It's been a while, my friends, and although the break produced some positives for yours truly, it feels great to be back behind the microphone. I mentioned on a previous episode that I dealt with a little bit of a health scare in May. One of the biggest takeaways from that situation was that I was pushing myself way too hard. Between writing, podcasting, consulting for stations and individuals, pursuing new opportunities, traveling, I simply ran out of gas and needed to recharge the batteries. Now, those who know me will tell you convincing me to slow down, that's a tall order. But when you're laying on a hospital bed with an IV in your arms, and that request is being made by a guy wearing a long white coat and reviewing x-rays of your organs, things just seem a little bit different then. So I took the advice, slowed down, declined a few projects, and now here we are, ready to tackle the podcast space once again. Now, since the show has been gone for 2 months, I've decided to refer to the past episodes as being part of Season 1. That means today marks the beginning of Season 2. And so for the first installment, I'm glad to be joined by Josh Innes. Now, Josh hosts mornings on Sports Talk 790 in Houston. He also does middays on Sports Radio 1280 in New Orleans. He's no stranger to the Sports Talk format, and he has a large share of fans as well as a large sea of critics. I'm sure that some areas of our conversation will generate a reaction, but I think you'll find this interview to be very informative, honest, mature, and most importantly, interesting. That's coming up in just a few minutes. For those of you listening for the first time, thanks for checking out the podcast. If you've been here before, then you're very familiar with the Jason Barrett public plea. Take 1 minute and leave a review for the podcast on iTunes. That's my only request. If you have the time to do something extra, sharing the episode on Facebook or retweeting it on Twitter, that also is greatly appreciated. But now that the promotional part of the episode has been satisfied and I've brought you up to speed on the reason for the podcast's hiatus, it's time now to dive into some actual content. And I usually start off with a monologue in what I refer to as the starting point. I may bring that back at some point, but since there have been a number of topics out there worthy of addressing, I'm going to shake things up on this first episode and begin with what I call the 5 and 5.
There are 5 minutes remaining.
The much-anticipated 30 for 30 on Mike and the Mad Dog aired, and credit to ESPN for taking a chance with the documentary. Selfishly, I wish the episode would have had a second hour. However, I understand ESPN's trepidation, given that they were featuring a radio show in a 30 for 30 for the first time, and it had a very regional pull. That being said, as I watched this film, I was reminded of how silly some things are in our business, and how many of us fail to appreciate what we have because our egos get in the way. Whether it was the scene about who's going to get the power chair or complaining about a canceled flight, many sports radio people make a mountain out of a molehill, and it isn't until they're knocked down a peg or stripped completely of what they had do they realize how good they had it. Chris and Mike were the toast of New York for nearly 2 decades. Their influence on this business is undeniable. The only question now is, will they produce a sequel worthy of another 30 for 30? The second story I want to touch on also involves Mike Francesa. The WFAN afternoon host went on the offensive this week, stating that reports of his ratings loss to Michael Kay were a fabrication. Now, when I first heard this, I was stunned. Mike is a sharp guy. He's had a lot of success. But he also knows that 3 months of ratings equal a book. And if monthly reports didn't count or matter, Nielsen wouldn't measure them, and station officials wouldn't analyze them. Michael Kay openly acknowledged on Twitter that he lost the spring book to Francesa. He gave him credit where it was due. But he also took some credit for himself for a narrow win in June. I don't have a dog in the fight, and Francesa can try to sweep it under the rug all he wants. A 5-2 to a 5-1 may be very small, and it may turn out to be short-lived. but a win is a win. To suggest that the reports are a fabrication is foolish. Even Mike Francesa knows better than that. Before Jamie Horowitz was ousted at Fox Sports 1, a controversial call was made to eliminate all written content on FoxSports.com. MTV chose to do the same, and now we find talented writers and reporters like Ken Rosenthal, Jason Stark, and Bruce Feldman writing content and posting it on Facebook instead of a brand's website where it could produce additional traffic and revenue. According to research, the audience's attention has shifted heavier to social media and video, especially millennials. 87% are never without their smartphone, and 92% browse on other devices while watching television. This is why network executives, though, are concerned. They see less eyeballs and dollars flocking to written work and television and want to be sure they're in the right spaces to maintain strong financial positions. You can't blame them for pursuing strategies that are better for their bottom line. I just wish that the written word didn't need to be rendered extinct to justify it. How many times have we played the game of, would you do this or that for $1 million? It's an exercise aimed at testing your convictions, but little do we expect to be faced with that exact scenario. Well, it happened to Clay Travis. According to the New York Daily News, Jamie Horowitz offered him his own show on FS1 and a whole lot of cash. All he had to do was give up talking about politics. He couldn't discuss them on TV, radio, Twitter, anywhere. After taking a day to think about it, Clay declined. By no means was my situation even remotely close, but I can relate because I left San Francisco in January 2015 to pursue custody of my son. Had a great gig with a great company, was well compensated, and had no job waiting back home. Giving everything up was hard, but when I weighed being known as a great PD versus being known as a great father, the choice was easy. Had Clay said yes, he might have been able to give his wife and kids a few more things, but he'd never have felt good or right about it. You can't put a price on your principles. Credit to Mr. Travis for standing firm. There comes a point in time where you have to ask yourself, are the ratings worth doing what we're doing right now? Sports has become less fun because we spend so much time and energy highlighting what's bad instead of what's good. On-air talent would rather spend time dissecting an individual's personal decisions instead of discussing a game or incredible play. And the latest example is ESPN's decision to air O.J. Simpson's parole hearing. O.J. Simpson hasn't been relevant to the sports world for decades. This is simply a cheap attempt to use the network's muscle following its airing of the O.J. Made in America series to produce a new chapter of the story. And given that O.J.'s murder trial generated massive interest in the past, ESPN is hoping to use Simpson as a pawn to attract eyeballs to its airwaves. I'm all for taking risks, but sometimes your integrity and credibility are much more important. ESPN chose to ignore them, which is exactly what I'll be doing to ESPN this week when they air O.J. Simpson's parole hearing. And that concludes the first edition of the 5 and 5. Let me know what you thought of it and any of the points I raised. You can reach me by email, jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com, or on Twitter, @sportsradiopd. It's time now to bring you my conversation with Josh Innes. We went through the trials and tribulations of his career and covered a number of different industry topics. I usually try to keep interviews between 30 and 45 minutes, but this one was very interesting and it ran just under an hour. I hope you enjoy the additional material. And now, without further delay, here's our conversation. 3, 2, 1. You're born in Missouri, grew up in Louisiana. Love listening to Jack Buck and the Cardinals on the mighty KMOX. But you also had the benefit of being around radio because your father has been a broadcaster. In fact, he's the voice of Shaggy on Scooby-Doo, for those who don't know. So take me through how that upbringing fueled your passion to pursue a career in radio.
Well, my dad would crush me if I didn't tell you that he did Scooby and Shaggy at one point, because that's what he tells people all the time. And it is true. He did Scooby in a couple movies, 4 direct-to-video cartoons. He did Shaggy, I think, in 3 of those. And then he did Scrappy in the live-action movie. But being around that was interesting because there'd be days I'd get up. My dad did mornings at one point, and he'd take me to the radio station with him sometimes. He'd put me in production rooms, right? So, like, he'd be on the air, and he'd go, Josh, just sit here and just hit buttons, and I'll be back. And these people would walk in and they'd be trying to cut spots or something. They'd go, who the hell are you? Oh, Ennis has his kid in here again trying to spin records. So that was my childhood growing up, was being at radio stations, hanging out around radio people. And I always found it fascinating. But it wasn't until I guess I was 12, 13 maybe, that I truly wanted to do it. And what I really wanted to do was play-by-play, and I really wanted to be the voice of the Cardinals. That's kind of how everything got started on that end, because before that, I wanted to make movies. Mm-hmm. And I had a video camera, and you know, me and my buddies would go recreate movie scenes. Like, we would do the shower scene from Psycho, but it was just me and my buddy. So, like, I'd hold the camera, and you'd see my hand kind of come in there, and he'd be in the shower wearing a bathing suit, and we used to, like, add music to it, and I wanted to do that. And then my grandpa, he was this great guy, and he cleaned parking lots at like 4 a.m, mowed people's lawns when he was 70, 80 years old, just a really cool guy. But he would also kind of dig through the garbage. And one day he came home, he had a talk boy from Home Alone 2, which is just basically a cheap recorder, and I would start recording these Cardinals games. I'd sit in his basement and just call the games into the recorders, you know, and I'd watch, and then he and I would listen to Jack Buck and Mike Shannon on the radio in the car, and like we'd go drive around and listen to it, and that's where I started to really get into it. When I was, I guess, 13, 14, living in Louisiana, I would just sit in my dad's truck in the driveway at home and back up and down in the driveway listening to Camel X. And I eventually started doing hockey play-by-play on the radio when I was 14 or 15. Then I did minor league baseball play-by-play when I was 16, 17. I had done the hockey play-by-play, and they basically let me do it because it was kind of a gimmick, and my dad would talk about it on the radio. But it turned out I was pretty good at it. Like, I did a demo tape by letting a video game play against itself, a computer simulation, and I did that for 2 years. And then a guy named L.J. Dupuy, who was a scout for the Yankees at one point, ran this baseball team in the Southeastern League of Professional Baseball, this really kind of dinky six-team league. I mean, it was what it was. My dad talked to him once, and they say, Josh, they want you to come out there and try to do the PA announcing for them. I said, all right, I'll go meet them. He says, do you want to do the PA? I said, well, actually, I'd rather do play-by-play. He goes, well, you know, we're not on the radio or anything like that. So I asked him about the Internet. And Internet stuff was still in its infancy then. You know, you might remember sportsjuice.com, you know, where it was one of those places where you'd go and they'd have all sorts of random minor league games like the Macon Whoopee versus the such and such. So what I did is he said, listen, why don't you talk to John Henry? And John Henry was John Henry Williams, the son of Ted Williams. I believe that John Henry was the guy that decided to freeze his dad's head. That was his controversy. He froze his dad's head. But he was nice to me, and he was trying to live out his rock and roll fantasy through this minor league team, and he had some money. So he said, hey, I think I know a guy that can get the games on the Internet. And now, like, literally, you could use an app on your phone to get a show on the Internet live. But yep. Back then, I had a phone. At the time, I had listened to Marty Brenneman doing a game once for the Reds, and they called it Reds on Radio. And the team that I was doing the games for was the Baton Rouge River Bats. So I called it Bats on Broadband. My dad got me a banner made. We used one of my low-power FM transmitters to broadcast into the stadium. And then we would broadcast online. And I would get emails from Florida and Georgia and Maine and Texas of these people like, hey, my nephew's on the team. Boy, you sound good. Are you really only 16? And I would go to message boards and I'd be like, hey, you guys hear this 16-year-old guy that's doing play-by-play? Sounds really good. What are your thoughts? And of course, they're all like, yeah, he's terrible, and he's only got a job because of his dad. I wasn't out trying to get laid or anything like that when I was in high school. Like, I was just in my bedroom trying to find different ways to do radio shows.
Whether you're learning the business 13, 14, 16, you've got advantages there that, you know, not a lot of guys tap into until they get out of school. So that was a good start for you. When did you finally start collecting a check?
In 2005, Katrina was about to happen. And, you know, I worked at Clear Channel in Baton Rouge, or I didn't even work there. My dad did. And he goes, Josh, if you want to get your foot in the door, now's the time to go up to the radio station and tell them you'll do anything they need you to do. I said, all right. I went up there and I said, listen, my program director was a guy named Matt Kennedy. I said, what do you need me to do? He said, listen, I need you to call all the different offices of emergency preparedness, find out about business closures, work closures, school closures, et cetera. I said, all right, I can do that. So I start calling. And like, I don't even know what I'm doing, but it's like you didn't think about it. You just said, all right, I'm going to call these people and I'm going to ask them. So then they start going to me for updates on the school closures. So they're like, all right, let's go to Josh Ennis, who's got the latest on what schools are closed. And I'd be like, yeah, hey, guys, thanks. The West Baton Rouge Parish schools are closed tomorrow. And I went up there, and that's how I got a part-time gig, was going up there during Katrina. And then they said, all right, you know, we'll give you a part-time gig, $8-$9 an hour, whatever it was. So then I'd have to go up on Saturday mornings, and I had to run just some of the worst programming. It was like a show about the Southern Jaguars, followed by a high school sports show where these two old coaches gave out last night's scores. Then I would go to the news talk station, and I would run a gardening show called Harb's Oasis. Then I would run this really bizarre show that was all scripted. It was just about safety, but it was scripted, so I'd have to follow this script. I did that, then eventually I got a full-time job out of that. My job was to be at the radio station from 3 p.m. until 11 p.m. We were like the emergency preparedness station, I guess. Or so there was the black phone, and if it ever rang, you had to answer it and all this stuff. So I would do a show from 3 to 4. Then I'd go just bullshit with my dad for a while, and we'd go sit in a studio. Then I'd go eat dinner. Then I'd come back at about 7 and just babysit the stations. I was supposed to run the Hornets basketball, but I would just forget about it sometimes, like, because it was on a station that nobody could hear at night. So my program director would call, and he'd go, how far behind on spots are you on the Hornets? And I'd be like, boy, I'm just going to blow through a lot of the network spots here because I'm about 15 minutes behind. But I did that. I ran the Saints games on Sundays. Now, that I didn't screw with. Like, people could hear it. It was on WJBO, so, I mean, you had to be on every break for that. And then for Gustav, which people don't really know about, but that was a hurricane that more impacted Baton Rouge than Katrina did. And my boss said, Josh, I need you to go to, you know, the OEP and just start talking to people. I'm like, all right, I don't have any formal training in doing this stuff, but here I am just doing call-ins, talking to mayors and stuff like that. It was bizarre, but I didn't even think about it. I just did it, you know, and it was, I still have never gone to any school for it. I tried to go to LSU. I went for a couple of years, and it just, I had a job. I didn't feel like I would benefit from the broadcasting school anyway, and I know that there are a lot of people that have to take that route, and you're right, mine's a little unconventional, and there's some luck involved in it, you know, and I guess that's the beauty of nepotism to a degree. I don't feel like I've ever gotten any of these major market jobs because of who my dad is, much like I don't think Joe Buck has been the voice of basically sports on Fox for 20 years because his dad was Jack Buck at one point. I got my foot in the door because I was around it. But the GM at the station at the time, a guy named Dick Lewis, said, you'll learn more being around the building every day than you'll ever learn at school.
The path is different for many different people, but you certainly gain a lot more experience if you can get inside of a building. And having the advantage to get in it is one thing that helped you for sure, but the bottom line is if you weren't taking advantage of those experiences, you wouldn't get further once. So that's a good thing. The one thing I want to ask you about, because the first time you arrived on my radar was when I was in St. Louis, and I remember you had a profile on STAA talent with John Chlesnik, and he would let me know when you were filling in for Jim Rome. And I remember thinking to myself at the time, how the hell is this kid filling in on Jim Rome? And so I was always curious, how did that even materialize? You hadn't been on 5 days a week doing a major market at that point.
John, who you brought up from STAA, when I was in Baton Rouge, he sent me a couple of job postings, both of which were in Houston. One was, you know, for an on-air audition on 790, which is the station I'm at now, and one was for a third guy on a morning show, which was at CBS. And I was supposed to go to Houston, and then the same day I was going to do the on-air audition, then I was going to go to 610 and talk with Gavin, who was my boss at the time, or wasn't yet, but became my boss. Well, they had to cancel the on-air audition, so I was already there. And I called Gavin, and I said, listen, Gavin, I'd love to be on with, you know, I want to be on your station. CBS seems like the place to be. You guys have the Texans, you know. So we met at a Starbucks by the radio station, and we talked a lot, and he didn't tell me I had the job then, but I think it was pretty well understood that I did. So I got that job. That was in November of 2009. And then I got the Rome thing was in, I think, it was July 9th. It was the day of the decision, the LeBron decision, and that was the day I filled in. I think the reason they used me is not necessarily because I was all that good, although Jason Stewart has since told me he thought I was like one of the best fill-ins they had. But I think what it was Rome was struggling in these major markets. He was still on Premier at the time. They asked, and mm-hmm. I guess Gavin recommended me. I sent them some audio. They used me that day. It was a good day to be on. And then I did, I think, 7 or 8 more fill-ins for Rome. And I still talk to Jason. I wouldn't say frequently, but because I've always had a dream to work in L.A., so every now and then I'll send him a message and say, hey, you got a job for me in L.A. yet? Because he likes what I do. Now, I don't think syndicated has the same pop it used to, but hosting the Rome show, when it was on Premier Radio still, before it was on the really homogenized CBS sports thing, and there's an audience thing, too. Like, you go fill in, and this is no slight against anybody because I like these guys, but like say like a Jody Mack, who does a shift on CBS Sports Radio, and he's one of my friends, I love him, there's not really an audience expectation in that sense, mm-hmm. where it's not like there's such a loyal group of wackos that like him that are like, you know, the clones. You know that they're going to judge you differently because they're the clones, and that's what they do. And I think in a lot of the stuff I did on there, and a lot of it I think was funny, but it's different from what I do now because I think back then I was like a lot of these young kids are now trying to be Cowherd, and I think that's the biggest mistake anybody can make is, you know, like Rome at one point was the guy that all the guys emulated. Now it's Cowherd, and I think to a degree I was still myself, but if I were to go back and listen to that, I think I'd go, yeah, this guy sounds kind of like a smarmy Cowherd wannabe who's 23 years old, has no real life experience. Yet I'm sitting here trying to tell grown-ass men how to live their lives. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I know I went kind of in a different direction there from hell. I don't even remember the question, to tell you the truth.
No, it's okay. You know, that's the beauty of podcasting. We're having a conversation. You know, you mentioned how you allowed what you were hearing from other talent to influence you. I think we all went through that at one point when you were young. When you started doing Rome and you got those opportunities, correct me if I'm wrong, at that point, were you doing the one-hour show and anchoring on 6-10? You hadn't started working yet with Rich Lord, right?
I was on from 6 to 10, and then I did an hour bridge to Rome. So almost right after I'd gotten there, the guy that was doing afternoons left, but I ultimately didn't get that gig. Then a year later, I got the gig.
So let's go there because obviously, you know, that's when you really start to get into a 5-day-a-week run. You're in a big drive time spot in a major market, but you're also doing a show with someone who's the established guy who does a very different show than the one you like to do. And it took you a lot, you know, of getting to know him. And you obviously had some bumps in the road while you were going through it. What was that experience like and what did you learn from
it? One of the things is we didn't talk a lot about the show, which I think hurt to a degree. Like, looking back on it with Rich, I don't really have a problem with him anymore. And you can go listen to some of those shows, and I'd say they were actually pretty decent shows because we were slightly different. And I think I elevated Rich to a degree because I think there, if you work with me, there's, like, basically to survive, you have to kind of elevate your game as well so we can have a rapport. There were some shows we did that were really good. My biggest issue was and remains that I felt like he tried too hard to make me a villain or make it sound like all of my opinions were so outlandish so he could be the good guy that I think it impacted people's perception of me. And that's not to say that I'm infallible in all of this. We all make mistakes in what we do. We all handle things poorly or sometimes right, sometimes wrong. But I think what happened there is if I would say something, he made it a point to make it sound like I'm just the anti-Houston, anti-whatever guy. And I think that's what kind of built that image of me being this, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, is hater or I think I'm a natural contrarian. That's just how I am. I mean, if you say left, I'll say right. And it's not like I'm trying to do it. It's just how I am. But when I look back on it, there were some really good times there. We had some runs that were good. Sometimes he just didn't really like me. There were things he did I didn't like playing raw press conference audio, I think is a waste of time for like 8 minutes on a show. I would bring it in and out of breaks a lot of the time, unless he had something he wanted to do. So he'd say, hey, I'm going to bring it back and play this audio. I say, oh, fine. But we didn't really have any structure to it. The bosses never really said anything about it. We just were, we kind of existed. And we didn't talk during breaks a lot of the time. I didn't tell him which direction I was going to go on a story. I would just bring it up. And that's the way we went. So I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do any sort of show. But I feel like partly we're kind of doing it the wrong way. But it worked. And up until Gavin left, we were doing really well. But once Gavin left, I really lost interest in being there. And that's why I eventually left.
So altogether, you spent about 4 years at 610. And the good part about going through some rough experiences and learning someone different who you have to grow into the relationship with is that it prepares you for the next spot. And let's face it, Philadelphia can eat you alive if you're not thick-skinned. And Andy Blum lured you to WIP. They start you in evenings with the idea being that they're going to elevate you to a key date part at an appropriate time. How would you describe for someone listening who wasn't there what those first 90 days were like?
When I got to WIP, they said, look out, this place is a snake's den. And it is. Philadelphia radio is filled with a lot of people who might portray themselves as, you know, thick-skinned, hard-ass people on the radio, but a lot of them are not. They're very petty. There's a lot of backstabbing. There's a lot of infighting. Like, when I got the job there, like, in Glenn Mack now, who's a hell of a nice man, like, I really grew to like him. I think he's a pro. I think he's a great man. When I got there, I got the night job, and they had moved in Rob Ellis, who's just not that good, into the afternoon spot to work with Anthony Gargano, who's an ass clown. And, you know, it lasted for however long, and then they eventually, you know, Gargano left. That's the other thing people tend to forget is he didn't get fired. He left. And they put me on. But it's funny because people, sometimes if people don't like me, they'll view me at WIP and they'll say, well, you know, Josh Ennis blew up WIP and he forced this guy out and this guy out. What would bother me so much is that I was considered this Judas that came in and tried to break up the family, when in reality, Anthony Gargano had gone behind Macnow's back to get him taken off the show. I think he handpicked Ellis and then they had a falling out. So there's a lot of bad stuff that goes on at that radio station and in Philly radio in general, but I kind of had to take the heat of it because I was the new guy that they elevated and, you know, all the stories were about me. But what's funny about that now, like the first 90 days, I would hear stories about how Anthony didn't like me and he would talk about me behind the scenes. And to me, it, like, if you're talking about me off the air, I'm not going to say anything about you unless you come after me first. So when I heard that, I would go on the air and just make fun of his bad show. And it's a shame, too, because, like, I don't think I'm a revolutionary, because that's hard to be. I don't think really anybody is anymore. I think most things have been done. But when I was in Philly, like, my show was so radically different, and it wasn't intentional. It was just that everything there was so bland and homogenized, and it was, hey, who's your favorite Philly of all time? And it was just dreadful. There was a formula. And I was told, all right, here's what you need. You need to have the sports topic. Then, like, you can ask kind of a non-sports question that people can answer, but they have to answer the sports question, too, when they call. But you could say, hey, today is April 12th, the anniversary of the Titanic sinking. What do you think is the biggest disaster in the history of Philly sports? Like, it's like there was this formula, and I think I shook up the formula a little bit. And, yeah, there was a lot of backlash from some people, but the ratings were gigantic with Tony. We were number one for the couple of months we were together. Then I was number one for another 7 months after that. People forget that. But they always try to find a way to undermine what we were able to accomplish. I don't know that anybody in Afternoon Drive in Philly did what me and Tony did, then what me and the other guys were able to do after that. Like, we were pulling 9, 10, 11 shares, and there were a lot of factors that came in there. I mean, it was Chip Kelly thing happened where he was a racist, allegedly. Then they got Sam Bradford. I mean, there was a lot of good things that had to happen, but, you know, we did well. And, you know, the question you asked was the first 90 days there. The on-air stuff, I think people, a lot more people gravitated toward the stuff I was doing. My regret is that I let the very vocal group of hate eventually kind of damage my opinion of the city as a whole. Then I just became an angrier person on the radio. And I think that ultimately was more part of my demise there than anything.
It's almost like two different chapters, because you have the one where you start out on nights, everybody's looking at you going, they've got bigger plans for them. They put you into afternoon drive. You and Tony take off. You're having tremendous success. But then Tony leaves, what, five, six
not
months
even,
later?
I showed up to work one day. They said, Tony's not coming to work. I didn't get a call from him. I didn't call him. It really just came down, like, really fast. He said he wasn't going to come in. They were worried because the show. And Tony never struck me as someone who was enjoying it. I mean, he's had a great career, and he's a cool guy. I really like him. And I think that he was never really comfortable with the role, I guess, or the duo show that we were doing. He always kind of wanted to do his own thing. And now he's out of it. He doesn't seem to like radio at all. He does podcasts. But I show up to work. He's not there. They say, you know, they're concerned that he's not going to come back. And ultimately, he didn't come back. So then it became, you know, we did a whole thing about how Tony retired, which he essentially did. I mean, he's not doing a radio show anymore. But that was a really odd situation. The thing that bothered me, and I guess this is just the world of social media, blogs and everything, or the world of being a celebrity, which in Philly, if you're on the radio, I guess, you know, you're a de facto celebrity. But all the stories were, you know, Tony Bruno leaves because he hates Josh Ennis. Well, that I don't think that was true, but he never told me that when it was happening. If he hated me, he never told me. He would come in, do the show. We had some laughs. He never told me he hated me at all, but all these stories would be out there, and I don't know who floated to whom, but it was that Tony hated Josh, and that's why he quit. He was upset that Josh was blank, blank, and blank. And I don't believe that stuff. It may be true, but he just quit. So, but I obviously get the bad rap on it. Like, here's a little nugget, just to kind of show you how much people were out to get me and how I shook up the landscape there. When I was there, every freaking month, these blogs would write stories about the ratings, right? They would come up with these idiotic reasons for why I was losing when I wasn't. Like, well, the streaming rating is like a 6. Because you combine streaming and on the air, they're beating you by 5 shares. Yeah, dipshit, the streaming rating is one person. That's one person listening to the stream. Like, you realize the ratings are already flawed, right? But this is just absurd. But, of course, they would spin this stuff and make me look bad. Now that I'm gone, notice that you never, when you look at the Philadelphia blogs, the Crossing Broads, the Philly.com, how many rating stories do you see anymore that were detailed down to the 2554, the 12+? They would write these stories. And I guarantee you that stuff was either coming from somebody in sales or in programming, probably at 97.5, or somebody that had it out for me that didn't like me, because they would always make news. Now that I'm gone, magically, there's no longer stories about ratings in Philadelphia, or at least not details where it's like, well, he had a 7.5 on air and a 13 on the stream for a 40 share.
Why do you think you were such a magnet for that stuff?
I'm not afraid to go after people, and I would go after the competition, so I had no problem with them coming after me. When we got there, we called their hotline, called them on the air. I mean, we did stuff, and I think because people would make these Stern comparisons, and then where they'd bring up Stern, so then people had this idea that I was ripping off Stern, and it was a bunch of stuff. And so I get why I have a target. It's just funny that all these people talk about how much they don't like me, but they need me. I'm clickbait for them. And now that I'm gone, hell, for the first couple of months I was gone, they would do stories about how I got a job in Houston, or they were doing stories in Philly about my ratings in Houston. Funny now, I get so many messages from people like, dude, we really miss you here. Radio stinks here. It's no fun. And again, I'm not a revolutionary. Stern's a revolutionary. Rush is a revolutionary. These are guys that basically started a whole format, a genre. But I was just different, I guess. I was different enough where you would go, I think this guy's not bad. I think he's pretty decent. He comes in spitting fire. He's not your typical meathead that comes in here on the air and panders. Like, I hate panders, people that go on the air and try too hard to say, hey, I'm local on this. Sometimes you got to be critical of the sacred cows. It just happens. And I think that's why people thought I was a troll or whatever they thought I was. But and then there'd be stories that would get leaked by people that would be like, you know, Josh's boys with the program director, which I was. Most talent is. I mean, unless you're Mike Francesa, right? I mean, most people have a decent relationship with their program director.
Yeah.
But for me, that was a bad thing. Like, am I supposed to just hate him? Am I supposed to hate Andy? is that what I'm supposed to do? Like, nothing was ever good enough for the people there. I think they tend to be an angry group of people in Philadelphia. They're a weird combination of this arrogance, yet this self-loathing all at the same time. It's a very strange combo there in Philly, but, I mean, I wouldn't classify what happened there as a disaster or anything like that, but once Andy got fired, then I got suspended not too long after Andy got fired, then I kind of lost interest. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my problem, is once somebody I care about gets whacked, or in Andy's case, let go, the passion existed because of Andy. Andy has this ridiculous desire to win. Like, he would talk about, like, Machiavelli and all these Sun Tzu, Art of War. Like, this is the kind of stuff we would talk about. And so my passion came partially because I wanted to impress him. I wanted these ratings. But then when Spike took over, his whole shtick was, yeah, we don't really care about ratings, you know? Like, it was, I can't work for someone who, whether it's true or not, it can't be, oh, don't worry, ratings don't really matter, just go do a good show. And I know ratings are flawed, and I know it's bullshit, but, like, I need someone that's like, hey, go out, and we're going to beat the competition. We're going to kick their ass. Now all they've done is gone and tried to recreate 97.5, so you got two radio stations doing boring stuff all day. And I feel like the audience is being underserved. What bothered me is I thought, hey, I come in every day, I'm prepped, I'm trying to do a good show, yet you guys gravitate more towards the junk. And I'm not perfect or anything like that. Again, I'm not a revolutionary. But that would bother me. Like, you guys are ripping me when you should be ripping these lazy bastards over here who are giving you nothing. They're actually insulting you with how bad the material they're giving you is, yet you're coming after me for trying to be different.
So I want to ask you about one specific thing, because you shared your passion and the way you gravitated towards Bloom. And obviously, you know, he brought you there. He had a lot invested in you, and he's a hell of a program director. And so I could understand being loyal to the guy who brought you there and who you believe in. But as you know, so many things happen in this business where change does happen, and how you respond to the next guy you work for ultimately determines if you stay there. And so Spike may be different in his tone and his personality and what drives him versus Andy. But as you know, as you're going through now in Houston, they could change people tomorrow. Right now, you were brought to Houston by a certain set of people. If they were all gone tomorrow, you would look back at your Philly experience and go, all right, I remember how it changed from Bloom to Spike. How am I going to make sure I get through this so I stay in a positive frame of mind and keep myself excited about the job? What did you learn from that experience that you might carry forward with you going into a future situation if all of a sudden you lost someone in Houston that you were tight with?
The difference with Andy was that was such a hostile situation in Philly that he wasn't only a programmer, but he would be a psychiatrist. I would stay up at the radio station till 8, 9 o'clock at night, or I'd text him at all hours of the night. Like, we had that kind of relationship, that kind of bond. It wasn't just like, you know, hey, this is, you know, my boss. So, you know, I felt like he was one of my true allies in a place where I felt like maybe I didn't have as many allies, or maybe I had more than I thought, mm-hmm. but in my mind it was, you know, all these, I convinced myself that the whole city hated me and everybody hated me, because that made it easier for me to be a jerk, I guess. But mm-hmm. I'd like to think I'd handle it differently. Like, I have good management here. Like, credit has to be given to Brian Erickson, who's essentially the program director, and Eddie Martini, who runs the cluster, who's one of the coolest people I've ever met, because, and you know this for a fact, boy, whenever you're riding high in Philadelphia, man, all these other companies really seem to like you. Your agent calls you, and he's like, hey, this station in this big town, and this station in this big town. And then you get fired in Philadelphia, and then all of a sudden, that well runs dry. They're like, yeah, I don't know about this guy anymore. We don't really think so. Now, granted, I think a large part of that is they knew a merger was coming. So, I mean, I'm not going to get hired by one company when they're going to become the company that just fired me. So now it makes a little bit more sense. But the one thing they did here, which I appreciate, is they brought me in when there were a couple of other places, like Portland was a place that was interested. Memphis was a place that was interested. I think there was one other big city. I'm not sure who it was, but they didn't let the perception of me, which, fair or unfair, the perception of me is that, you know, I'm hard to deal with, and that I'm controversial, and that I'm racist, and all this stuff. They didn't let that stop me from being interested in me. and that's why I work here now. So, like, I thought about that, the question you asked about, you know, what I would do if somebody got here. And I'd like to think that what I learned from that is, you know, there aren't infinite opportunities. Like, when you're 25 and you're the hot guy, I think the opportunities are infinite. But with the way these companies are merging, the way the business is kind of shrinking in a way, those opportunities aren't always there. And I learned that whenever all these people liked me, and then all of a sudden they didn't like me all that much. So the fact that these guys were loyal to me here and wanted me, I'm extremely loyal to them. But on the other hand, if one of them got let go or quit or went to somewhere else, I'd be very upset about it, because these are the guys I came to work for. But I think now, given that I'm a little bit older, given that I do have a good job here and I do like living here and I'm about to do the morning show here, I don't think I'd let it bog me down as much as I let the Andy thing bogged me down. And keep in mind, like, here, I don't need a shrink here, because the situation at this radio station is not as toxic as the situation was at WIP. So I didn't constantly need to talk to somebody about it. But here, it's just a little bit happier, and the people are a little bit nicer, and there's a lot less infighting and backstabbing. So I choose to believe that now, if, you know, Eddie, who I have a really good bond with, he's the one that put me on in New Orleans as well, and that starts Monday. I choose to believe that it would suck, but I think I'd handle it a little bit more maturely. Like, the second Andy got let go, I was on the phone with my agent saying, all right, let's get out of here. Or the second Gavin said he was going to Dallas,
right,
I said, I got to get the hell out of here.
In those situations, what's tough is, if you're Spike Eskin or you're Ryan McCredden, you're almost put in a situation where I'm not going to root for my own guy, because I know he's not giving me that latitude to build a relationship. And maybe you had already known those guys to the point where the relationship wasn't going to be built. But the bottom line is, if that's who becomes the boss.
I think, though, the two things were different in that Gavin, I didn't really want to do that show with Rich anyway. Like, I had decided that I didn't want to do the show anymore. You know, I didn't even know Ryan, but I knew that I didn't want to stay on that show. I just felt like I had outgrown it to a degree, or I wanted something new. And Silly, I knew Spike, and I knew I didn't want to work for him. It's hard to work for someone who you did a show with, if that makes sense. And I knew that I didn't like the direction that they were going to go. I'm not going to be overly critical, because, I mean, like, I was a jerk too, don't get me wrong. Like, the second Andy left, I mean, there were some things I did in Philadelphia that I'm not doing now that I'm glad I've moved on from. Like, I work with sales a little bit better now, and because I understand the bottom line part of it a little bit more, care more about it. I guess it's different when you have 11 shares and you're like, ha-ha, I'm the cock of the walk, you know?
Right.
And now when, you know, you have one shares in a market where, you know, you're lucky to get threes and fours, and that's kind of the ultimate goal, is, you know, you realize, and I think it's also who you work for. Here, they're more of, hey, let's make money. You know, it's never going to be huge here. You're never going to have 11 shares here. So go out, sell yourself, make money. Whereas in Philly, I felt like I shouldn't have to sell myself. This 11 share should sell itself. So I handled that poorly. But and these are all things I'm learning. And you know, I can understand where people have been critical of me before for the way I've handled certain things. And that's something I have to improve upon. And I think that there might be a reputation of me that, and you know better than me, you're basically a consultant, you hear what people say. I think there's a reputation that might be difficult to work with, might be, doesn't play well with others, which that one I would disagree with. But, you can tell me, but I think that would be the reputation that I probably have now, is that, and that's the thing I have to remedy. So people, I can understand where there might be a distrust of me from some, but what I'm doing here in Houston is trying to prove all those people that think I'm lousy and think that I'm a troublemaker and think that I'm, you know, self-serving and all that. I'm trying to prove to those people that they're wrong, and I'm trying to make my bosses here look really smart.
I do think people allow what they read to influence them. I think Twitter plays into that. Sometimes some people are going to look at your stuff on Twitter and go, hey, that's really funny and creative, and I like that he interacts with the audience. You're going to have other guys who go, I don't like that he's so candid about things on Twitter. You know, it just depends on who it is that you're in front of. Like, if someone called Andy Blum and asked for an opinion, they're going to get a high opinion. If they called Spike, maybe they wouldn't get that same opinion. That doesn't mean that there's not validity on both sides. So it just comes down to who that person is calling. Obviously, you've been in enough situations that nobody's going to question whether or not you belong on the air. Then it's just a matter of whether or not you're the right fit for somebody. One thing I wanted to pick your brain on, because I don't get it. We talked a little bit about the Philadelphia stuff and why you were polarizing to the local press. But, you know, Houston's went through this a little bit, too. Maybe not as much. But when you returned to the market, it was almost like, oh, my God, he's replacing the Holy Grail, Charlie Polillo. And I don't know, Charlie, but I look at it just objectively. The ratings were not strong. You do a very different show, which means you essentially have to build a brand new audience in Afternoon Drive. From the second you returned, there was all this local media negativity being aimed at, what's Josh Innes doing today? How do we generate a few clicks off of his name? Do we point out that his ratings are low? Why was there so much of that?
Yes, I'm vastly different in the approach than Charlie was, but local media people have always disliked me, and I'm not afraid to go after them, but it's funny how there's just this real negative vibe about me. Like, they want to keep perpetuating this, you know, shock jock thing, which isn't real. I mean, I don't sit around and tout my knowledge and tell you how much I know about sports, but because I talk about boobs on occasion or movies, I must be, you know, a shock jock or whatever. But the local media has always disliked me here, although there are some that I'm friends with. And again, it's one of those things where I get that I bring it on myself because I'm willing to call people out and I'm willing to try. You know, you're a wrestling guy. I see it on your Facebook all the time. I was an NWO guy. I'm a Bischoff guy. So, you know, you got to create the controversy because, you know, that creates the cash. And I'll say this, the first time I was here, I made radio a news story. When I was in Philly, it was a much larger news story than it already was. And just look at it now, it's not nearly the story that it was since I left. And now that I'm back here, people write more stuff about radio. The part that bothers me about it is that, yes, the ratings are what we go by. But I took over in October, so I guess this would have been technically the September book of last year, September, October, before I took over. And I think Charlie had like a 2.5, which was an anomaly. It was the biggest month he had had all year. And it was
right,
because it was September, it was baseball, a couple of day games, playoff push. It's going to elevate it, which, you know, these stories don't mention that that's like 20th, by the way.
Right.
But it's like Charlie Polillo has a 2.6. Josh Innes comes in, loses half of the audience. Well, I lost half of the share. And if you go back and look at the month before or the year to year, it's basically the same stuff. Because when you're dealing with so few of these meters, and you can't explain this to people, but basically what the morning show has, if, you know, on a 5,000-watt AM station, more than likely that's kind of what your afternoon is going to have. You know, there's two or three meters to go around. It's tough. But, of course, the story becomes Josh Innes loses the ratings, and then all these people keep going after me. The frustrating part is they don't point out that 610, while they may win, they've lost a large chunk of the share. Like, they'll get some of it back for football. But when we were there a couple of years ago and the station was really cooking, we were consistently pretty dominant over the market. Now, that doesn't mean we were dominant as it relates to all of radio, but we were dominant among sports stations. The other stations didn't have a prayer. And now everybody's pulling ones and twos, and it stinks. But me, I become the target. Even though the station I'm on, our ratings weren't very good at the time. 610s were going down. The FM sports talker barely registers. But I'm the asshole.
In addition to some of the controversy that you brought up and how the perception has been shaped, one thing that many don't know about you is that you really study this business. I mean, you talked about some of it early on, how you would go back to the Jack Buck tapes, but you've told me in the past how you would listen back to old shows of Howard Stern, or you really try to learn from those who have done it well on a very high level. Why do you think that's important and beneficial for talk show hosts?
Most sports hosts don't do anything for me because most of them aren't radio people. A lot of them are, you know, writers or jocks that became analysts. I like to talk to radio people, and the coolest people I've met are people that were FM jocks, like a guy named Greg Thunder, who worked here in Houston on the country station. So he was one of these jocks that, you know, used to talk up records in the 80s, and he was awesome. Or Kid Kelly or Sludge, who works at WIP still, and he did all these different morning shows. Man Cow. these are the people I enjoy talking with because they're radio guys, not writers that became hosts or jocks that became hosts. I'm a radio guy. That's what I'm into. That's why I emulate a lot of these guys. And that was another point of contention where people would criticize me. Like, one story said that Josh Ennis and Andy Bloom would just sit around all day and watch old Stern tapes and rip them off, which was not true, but, like, we'd be shooting the shit, and he'd go, did you ever hear the Stern bit where he did blank? And I'd go, oh, yeah, let's listen to it. But I don't think there's anything wrong with listening to the way people who are highly successful do things. What you can't do is become carbon copies, and I think that's what we're getting. And I think everybody's basically just trying to sound like Colin Cowherd now, and no offense to him, he's obviously great at what he does. And, you know, Cowherd, when he hit the scene, his was a more cerebral sports talk. And to a degree, I think his style of sports talk is actually hurting sports fandom in that I think far too many people are concerned with shit they didn't used to be concerned about, like salary caps or the farm systems. And, like, I don't care about that kind of stuff. Like with the NBA, all these kids talk about the NBA now is the trades that happen, then the season happens, and no one cares. You know, it's basically like, you know, you do a full breakdown of the birthing process, but then when the baby comes, you're just like, eh, whatever, I'm not interested in the baby. The games don't seem to matter as much anymore. And people are so hell-bent on salary caps and being wannabe GMs and talking about TV ratings as if, you know, the average person cares. But I think that's kind of part of the Cowherd influence on things. And these kids in their 20s, they all want to be Cowherd. They all want to be the smartest guy in the room. They all are afraid of their own shadow, really. I mean, like, they go to Twitter, and it's all part of the echo chamber. Everything's extremely left. Nobody has the guts to even make jokes about sensitive things anymore. It's all very serious, and that's what you're getting on sports talk radio even more and more now. Let me give you Fox Sports 1 as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Their whole shtick was, we're going to be different than ESPN, and they'll play the whole angle of ESPN's too liberal. Then you go watch their staple shows, which are carbon copies of the ESPN shows that Horowitz did, and you listen to the opinions, and I don't care if you're right, left, whatever, but you watch them and you're like, there's no real difference between Shannon Sharp and Stephen A. Smith, and there's no real difference between Max Kellerman and, you know, Bayless. Like, nobody does anything different. First of all, like, I'm not one of these people that says we need more minorities or more women on the radio. I think people need to be where they fit. Like, I think Katie Nolan could do a funny show
right.
That might be different than, say, the two guys yelling at each other. I think Dan Levitard, while I don't agree with a lot of the stuff he says, the set with him in his kitchen with his dad makes me laugh. I think that's funny. I think he's kind of a counterculture. What people don't understand is it's not the job of the program director to break new social ground. No programmer's going to keep his job when he's got a one share because he's put four women on a morning show. No one thinks about that. They're like, boy, people need to take more chances. No, the job of a programmer is to get ratings and revenue. Your job when you were programming in San Francisco and St. Louis was not to be a social justice warrior and just out of spite put on a show that was specifically minorities or women or whomever hosting because you wanted to break new ground. Your job was to generate ratings. And
right.
Generally speaking, the mid 25-54 audience does not respond to women talking about sports. And more so, I'm talking about women, less about minorities. There are a lot more minorities on the radio than there are women in sports. But your job wasn't to do that. Your job wasn't to be a trailblazer. And, you know, they might write nice little stories about you on Huffington Post about how much of a trailblazer and pioneer you were. That ain't going to pay the bills. They ain't buying your raffle
right.
tickets.
I'll disagree with you on one point. At the end of the day, I don't care if a guy is white, black, if it's a woman, if it's an Asian, if it's Hispanic. If they're interesting and compelling and I think we can generate an audience with them, I'll do it. But what I will say about this issue that is an issue is if you look around the sports radio format, you will find one or two minority hiring managers. And it's easy for me as a 43-year-old white guy. I'm going to gravitate more likely to people who I know and methods I've seen work. I'm not going to be the social justice warrior. It's just not my thing. Yes, most of sports radio is white. Most of the audience is white. But let's just use your market. Let's use Los Angeles. Let's use Phoenix. They're not high-rated markets. Houston is 50% Hispanic. I don't see many Hispanics on the air. Now, I'm not telling you, just go put a Hispanic on the air and you're going to solve your ratings problem.
And that was the point I was trying to make. I know it might have sounded worse the way I delivered it. My point was, I keep hearing about how we need more blank, blank, and blank on sports radio or in sports media. Well, basically what you're telling me to do is just put someone on based on the color of their skin.
Right. That's like the whole, let's just give the female the sideline gig because she's pretty and she can talk for 30 seconds. Well, that's bullshit because, as you mentioned, there's a Katie Nolan who might be able to do 3 hours and be really entertaining. Maybe Michelle Beadle could do that. I don't know if they can or can't because they've never been given that spot. And I'm not saying every woman or every minority have the capabilities to do that. You know, there's a lot of white guys who can't do talk shows either. But that being said, if you're in a city where 50% are coming from one background, and Phoenix, LA, and Houston are three examples where ratings have traditionally not been high, the minority demographics are very different, and yet you look at all three of those, and I just happen to point those three out, Miami's the same thing. Unfortunately, one big issue is that there is also a lot less interest from minority candidates in this format. And so, you know, it's easy to say, well, we need to do better, and I do think we need to do better, but it's harder to justify that when 1 out of 100 applications come in from somebody who might be qualified. I'm curious, from your standpoint, how do you see sports radio evolving in the next 10 years? Because you're, what, 30 years old right now? The format just celebrated 30 years. How do you see this going in the future?
I hope it goes in a more interesting direction because, honestly, I don't listen to a lot of sports radio because it's boring to me. I will seek out Toucher and Rich in Boston because I think it's a funny show. They don't take themselves seriously. They're not blowhards. It's just funny. I will seek out Lebatard on occasion. The guy I think that doesn't get enough credit, I don't think he's a great like radio host per se, but I really like Clay Travis. Because I think he's a good media guy. I think he understands the way it works and the direction it's going, which is a lot of people are going to get tired of having their message squashed and the sphere of working for the man, as it were. I don't know Clay, but I think he's brilliant in what he's doing, which is, all right, I'm doing mornings on Fox Sports Radio. All right, so I'm building my brand. I'm adding new people to my brand every day. I've already got a well-established brand on Outkick the Coverage. I've already done TV with Fox College Football. Like, he's done a lot of things to build this brand up, and he's essentially, like, I don't think he needs the job. I mean, it's not a high-profile gig, if you really think about it, to do morning drive on Fox Sports Radio. I mean, you know, Cowherd's the big gun there. I mean, but, like, you know, there's drive times on syndicated networks are generally lost. I mean, people don't hear it. So he's probably on in a lot of smaller markets, medium-sized markets, probably kind of middle America market where his audience is going to come from, because while he's not a conservative, so to speak, he takes the other side, which is something not enough people do, because right now conservatism or common sense to a degree is being lampooned as racist or close-minded or bigoted. So Clay Travis can come out, and yeah, he might say some outlandish shit sometimes, but no more outlandish than a left-wing type of guy could say. But, of course, since he's a white guy that has a conservative-leaning show, although he votes Democrat, then, you know, he's the racist, whatever. But I think he's done a good job. You truly don't have opposing voices when it comes to radio, because these young guys of the Twitter generation are afraid to have a differing viewpoint. So what you get is just basically the same shit on every station. When I turn on the radio, I feel like a bunch of smarmy 20-somethings are trying to tell me why I suck at life. And that doesn't interest me. I'd rather have someone, you know, we shoot the shit about sports like we would at a bar. We make fun of each other. We laugh. We have a good time. And we move on. Like, I don't need guys on the radio talking about VORPs and war and all these sabermetric things that the average person who works a 9-to-5 and has a couple of kids, or he doesn't have time to give a shit about a VORP. He just knows that what he sees, whether he thinks the guy is good or not. Don't bog me down with shitty numbers. Don't bog me down with, you know, telling me I'm a bad person. Don't bog me down with Colin Kaepernick taking a knee. Like, just make me laugh. And if you're going to talk about Colin Kaepernick, maybe take a different angle on it. Make a joke. I mean, that's the thing that we've lost, is people now are afraid to make jokes about anything. It used to be you could joke about anything. Now if you joke about stuff, you're horrible. Unless that changes sports radio, and I know that people have a differing opinion, sports radio is going to be largely mundane and boring to me because it's dull. It just doesn't do anything. Doesn't
Social media anything. Plays into that too, for sure, because as you know, you could do a funny bit on the air, and it usually in the past didn't have legs to continue on for the day. But the second you do something now on the air and it goes on social, it starts to catapult. Now people who haven't even heard the bit are involved in the conversation, and they're sending tweets at your advertiser. And the next thing you know, you're being called into the market manager's office because they got to come up with a plan of how they're going to address it. And it's scary at times because you sit there and go, Jesus, we did something fun for 90 seconds that most of our audience like, but because now 1,000 people have developed this freaking snowball on social media, now we've got to come up with a answer for this, because everything you do on the air now is overly magnified based on what it's going to do on social after it's done.
So a couple of times I got in trouble in Philly was all based on stuff on Twitter. That's why I don't tweet anything or try not to tweet anything that could be misinterpreted. They told me I got fired because I posted a picture of Al Jolson on Twitter. Now, they were looking for an excuse to fire me, but like they called me into the office one day and they said, you have to stop talking about racial stuff because, well, Spike told me that even his black barbers thought I was racist or something. I forgot what it was exactly. But I'm like, well, that doesn't seem right because you have no issue with anybody else talking about these topics on the air, but you have an issue with me doing it. Why? So the thing happens at 97.5 where they have this fake black caller, and as a joke, I just tweeted a picture of Al Jolson, and I said, this guy probably calls 97.5, LOL, ha-ha. And people are so willfully ignorant, they don't even acknowledge that Al Jolson was famous for being a black-faced actor in the 20s. It's not like I just found or painted my own face black and said, ha-ha-ha, or just searched blackface on Google. It's a guy who's a well-known face that I had tweeted before and never got in trouble for it. But that's the way it goes. I mean, people that have never heard you before, they read your comments, and then they turn you into this uber villain, and it becomes a disaster. I mean, that scares the hell out of me. That's why I'll do it on the air, but I very rarely tweet anything now that could be any sort of controversy. It's not good. It gets really bad.
All right, I want to wrap up with you on something I call quick hits. I do it with every guest. Just a couple of quick four questions I'm going to hit you with, just the first thought that pops into mind. The best host in sports radio today, not named Josh Innes, who is it?
That would be Craig Carton.
The best advice given to you from a program director was?
They give me a lot. The thing is, I don't listen to any of them. That's my problem. The best advice, stay off of Twitter.
Who told you that?
All of them. But really, Andy was the main one, like, especially during a show. I know that some people like to use it as a resource, but I've seen it happen a lot where people get all sorts of whacked out. Like, they'll change the whole show based on something from Twitter. But that was some good advice. Oh, actually, you know what? I'll give Gavin credit and Andy for this. But get out on a high. You got to get out of something whenever, like, it's just about to start coming down. Keep things shorter. Be shorter. Because the longer it goes, the worse it gets.
The one market you hope to work in somewhere down the line that you haven't been in yet is?
Los Angeles.
And the one thing you would encourage a young person to do today who's interested in pursuing the business would be?
Have a dad that works in it and say offensive things. It'll get you far. Be interesting is what I would say. Don't listen to Cowherd and think that's the only way to do it. Don't watch the Nick Wrights of the world and think you have to be a social justice warrior on the radio. Because honestly, and I hate him with a passion, but people don't want to be told how dumb they are, or how, even worse, they don't want to be told how horrible they are. That's why Trump won. There were enough people that got sick of being told that, you know what? You're deplorable. So screw you. Watch what I can do. Like, don't be that way. It's sometimes you're going to have to get mad and yell at somebody or tell them they're stupid. That happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what you don't need to be is the guy that's telling everyone how dumb or how wrong they are, because most people are going to say screw you and turn you off. Make people laugh. Find a different angle on it. Don't just be recycling
ESPN stuff because you think that's what you have to do. I've gotten where I am because I think I'm a little bit different. Cowherd was different whenever he started. Rome was different when he started. And there are hiccups, and you're going to take some blowback, but in the long run, you have a better chance of being successful that way than you do of just being some stiff.
He's Josh Innes. You can hear him weekday mornings on Sports Talk 790 in Houston, middays on Sports Radio 1280 in New Orleans. You could also find him on Twitter at Josh Innes Show. Josh, this was a lot of fun. I enjoyed the trip down memory lane and appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Thank you, Jason.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
I hope you enjoyed that candid discussion with Josh Innes. Those who've listened to him, whether it be in Houston, Philadelphia, or Baton Rouge, certainly have opinions on his approach. Some love him, some loathe him, but he seems to have a pretty good track record when it comes to commanding the market's attention. There were so many layers of that conversation that fascinated me. I applaud Josh for being able to look back and identify areas where he may have made a mistake or two and acknowledge that he needs to grow from those experiences. The fact that he seeks out and listens to other successful personalities is another positive. There's absolutely nothing wrong with appreciating someone's talents, finding inspiration in how they operate, and using a few of their tricks to make your own presentation better. That's just smart broadcasting. In listening to his thoughts, the Philadelphia situation certainly seemed to take a toll on him, and for his sake and WIP's sake, it's probably a good thing that they got divorced. We'll never know how it would have turned out had Andy Bloom remained, but one thing you learn in this industry is that change happens frequently and often unexpected, and when it does, the next chapter or two of your career becomes very different depending on the path you take. Finally, Josh's points about needing to find your own unique style and voice and not attempt to replicate the exact formula and delivery of others is very valid. When I started off my career on the air, I was influenced by listening to Mike and the Mad Dog, but especially Chris Russo. If you haven't noticed already, I wasn't blessed with Mike Francesa's pipes, but I could relate to Chris because his voice was thin like mine and his passion and energy were high and infectious. I knew I could replicate those qualities, and when I began hosting shows, I definitely did. It took me a few years to learn, develop, listen to others, and ultimately figure out that the only way to progress as a host was to be the best Jason Barrett I could be, not Jason Barrett attempting to be Christopher Mad Dog Russo. Well, that's going to bring the first episode of Season 2 to a close. Again, my thanks to Josh Innes for making an appearance. A quick reminder that I serve as a sports radio consultant and strategist. My main focus is on helping brands develop and elevating their on-air, online, and on-social strategies. I also, though, work with select individuals from time to time. So if you're interested in talking business, you can find my contact information on the website, sportsradiopd.com. That's also how you could reach me if you have a news tip, press release, or industry-related question to pass along. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.